another edition of Turn Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grumbles into punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, one of the great documentarians of the early LA punk scene and of also the Seattle scene and the grunge explosion and heavy metal, like an amazing photographer, Alison Braun is on the show today. And if you're not familiar with her name, she's also known as Mouse, but if you're not familiar with Alison by name, you certainly are familiar with her images. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can head over to the email address turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me as soon as he can. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Left4Damien. And if you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is by telling everyone you know about this thing. You can also subscribe to it and rate it, or head over to patreon.com/turnedoutapunk. And thank you, thank you, thank you to all the people that do that and support the show over there. Very much appreciated. Also, huge thank you to the fine folks at Vans who came aboard a few years ago and started supporting this show, saying, Damien, do your show. Just don't do it out of your own pocket, and we will help you cover the cost of this thing. And they have, and it's been fantastic, and I can book whoever I want. And that's great. That's all I want to do is have the show and nerd the fuck out with people about punk, and they allow me to do that. So thank you to them. All right, on to today's show. Today on the show, Alison Mouse Braun is here. She is responsible for some of the most iconic images in various publications over the years, like Maximum Rock and Roll. She shot for Flipside, We Got the Power. She's shot in Social Distortion Records, albums. She is really one of the first people that was documenting that first wave of Los Angeles hardcore as it was kind of coming in. And it's fascinating. Her stuff is amazing. She has an incredible website and has an unbelievable book that I strongly recommend going out there and ordering. You can find that at alisonbraun.com. And yeah, she is truly, truly an amazing photographer. And then also someone that not only just documented that scene, but then she also starts documenting the LA metal stuff as that's kind of coming in, supplanting punk as the dominant cultural force. I know it pains me to say that too, in Los Angeles. And then ultimately she goes up to Seattle and shoots everything just before grunge really hit. So she's capturing a lot of those bands just as it's kind of, you know, cusping. So she's got an amazing perspective on the evolution of this music and an amazing person to talk to. Anyway, I'm not going to ramble on. You're going to hear it. Why am I hyping it for you? You've downloaded this podcast. Okay. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Alison Braun on Turned Out a Alison, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, as I was just telling you off air, I'm a huge fan of the images that you've shot over the years. And some of these images are burned into my mind. Like, it feels like I was at the show just from looking at your photographs.
Yeah, they're it's interesting that the memories that people get from them, those, some of those photos are almost 40 years old now.
Oh yeah. Well, and it's funny because, like, you know, like just some of these images, you know, like obviously some of the bigger name guys, but even like that Circle One image of the singer of Circle One at the Cuckoo's Nest.
It's oh, just, yeah.
That looks like it could be from a show like a week ago. Well, obviously not now a week ago, but like when there were shows like a week ago, like it feels, those images feel so timeless.
Yeah, that's the beauty of black and white photography, is that, you know, you can look at an image and it has a timeless feel.
Well, I'm going to get into all this with you, hopefully, okay. But I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is,
okay,
Alison, how did you get into punk rock? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
I believe, and again, I'm going back 40 years now. It was in the late 70s, you know, maybe 1979, that I started hearing, you know, the bands from older friends, you know, just things, bands like the Ramones and the Sex Pistols and Iggy Pop, just, you know, really old music. And I heard, you know, I heard that and I go, this is really interesting. You know, I like this, you know, it's fast, it's angry. It was, you know, not too different from some of the, you know, heavier rock music like Black Sabbath I was listening to. And it really spoke to me. And I, around 1980, I met some older kids at a party, and they were dressed as punks. And I thought, you know, these guys are cool, you know, and I hung out with them and they played me some music, and I ended up becoming friends with them. And they ended up sort of taking me in and taking me to shows in Hollywood, in, you know, at the Starwood and at the Whiskey. And these, you know, kids were a couple of years older, so they already had cars. And I just kind of came along for the ride and, you know, just got tossed into the scene, you know, just from the beginning, like, okay, here we're at, we're now at the Whiskey, you know.
Going back before that, you mentioned being in a Black Sabbath and
oh, yeah,
like the hard rock stuff. Where were you getting into, like, sort of like the heavier rock and roll at the time?
I was living in Los Angeles, and I, you know, couldn't listen to FM radio. I didn't like it then. So I went to record stores. You know, I don't know if people remember record stores, but you used to be able to go into a record store and peruse the stacks and listen to records. And, you know, it was an event that's so far behind us now that nobody does that. And I used to love to go to record stores and look at the album art. And a couple of albums I bought were not because I heard of the band, they're because I liked the album art. Mm-hmm.
No, you had to judge a book by its cover, kind of, when you're buying these records.
Totally. I'm buying, you know, Black Sabbath record. I'm like, this looks fun. You know, it looks interesting. And I also, you know, when my early punk days, I went and I bought a Germ-Free Adolescence by the X-Ray Specs. I love the cover. I mm-hmm. bought, I discovered The Clash by looking at London Calling and the picture of Joe Strummer smashing his guitar. And that's how I heard about The Clash, was just looking at the record and thinking it was interesting.
It's amazing how, yeah, like these things are just so arresting, you know, especially because like all these covers look so different from, you know, I guess pop records at the time.
Well, just records in general. I mean, mm-hmm. to buy, if you look at an old album, it's big. It has big artwork on it. They came with posters in them, and holding an album is an event. You know, it was just like, it's the art in and of itself. It's sort of weird and anticlimactic when people get CDs and everything is shrunk, or now you don't even get any CDs. You just stream the music and the artwork is, you know, gone unless you look at a screen capture online.
Yeah. And now it's like a, you know, it's gone from being this CD, which was, you know, how many inches, 4 inches, 5 inches,
right,
to now like an inch.
Yeah. And, you know, this is not punk rock, but to your point, one of the most arresting album covers I'd seen was an Elton John album cover. It was Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy. And there is so much going on that album cover that if you shrunk it down to CD size, you kind of miss the impact.
Definitely. So were you kind of aware of the sort of pre-punk 70s punk stuff that was happening at the time? Like Runaways and Zolar X and those types of bands?
Oh yeah. I lived in the Hollywood Hills, and I had the benefit of growing up just, you know, 2 miles from the Sunset Strip. So I had the benefit of being aware of the clubs in the Sunset Strip, being aware of the Runaways, being aware of, you know, the record stores in the scene on the Sunset Strip, because that was pretty close to where I lived. And it was not hard to access. There was a really nice Tower Records on Sunset Boulevard that was very close to the clubs. And I used to go there and kind of peruse what was going on. And also Melrose Avenue at the time was big for punk rockers to go and hang out and walk the streets. And so that was, you know, all part of the Hollywood scene. So it was really easy to see what was going on before you even did anything, you know, mm-hmm. because it was Los Angeles. And for that, I'm thankful that I didn't live in, you know, another city that didn't have that rich nightlife that Hollywood had.
Yeah, it's amazing because Keith Morris was just on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. And exactly. Uncle Keith around the house, we call him. But he was kind of going into this idea that, you know, like you look at CBGB's punk, you look at New York punk, you look at all these other things, like even the British punk, like Los Angeles is where we really get the punk that we know today. Like that's really where you get the beginning of the slamming. You get like so much stuff that we just associate with punk rock is really out of LA more than it's out of New York.
Yeah, and what's funny you should say, you know, mention Keith. I've known Keith now almost 40 years. He was one of the first people I ever met when I shot a Circle Jerk show. I became friendly with their original drummer, Lucky, and I met Keith through Lucky. And, you know, Keith was just a really great guy, really interesting, and, you know, kind of one of the early friends that I made as a musician in the scene.
Yeah. What was the first show you went to? Actually, even before, I guess, punk rock, I guess. Right. What was the first concert you went to?
The first concert, period? Well, I'd like to call my second concert, but the first concert I went to was in 1975. I saw Peter Frampton. Don't judge me.
That's not bad.
my second concert I went to was in 1976. I saw Kiss and Cheap Trick.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And yeah, I was much more aware of that because I became aware of the photographers that were shooting Kiss. And I thought, I'm going to do that someday when I saw them.
Like, is that where I guess that's the first interest you had in photography, period, seeing that at the Kiss show?
No, my father was an amateur photographer and he got me my first camera. And he had always been the guy with the camera and taking pictures, and he was really into photography. And it was a hobby that he and I shared together. You know, I don't think he planned for me to go combing around, you know, Hollywood taking pictures of punk rockers, but he endorsed photography as a good hobby for me.
That Kiss Cheap Trick show that you went to, it's amazing. There's been, I think, you know, maybe a half a dozen different people that have been on the show over the years that went to that show. If it's the same, it must be the same one. Like, I can't imagine Kiss.
Yeah, it was at the Forum.
That must have been sort of like a watershed music moment for a lot of people that would wind up being that sort of formative first generation of punk rockers in LA.
Oh, totally. And my dad took his camera and we took pictures at the show. I wasn't in the pit. He had a business acquaintance, and, you know, I don't know what, you know, what the guy's real name was. My dad always called him Shady Shikey, and Shady Shikey somehow would come up with tickets to Dodger games behind home plate, tickets to Kiss when we wanted them, tickets to, you know, to Peter Frampton. I got tickets to the Cars because somehow Shady Shikey, you know, got these tickets, and they were always really good tickets. So I don't know what my dad did or who this guy was that got us tickets. But when I say I wanted to go to a concert, my dad somehow would procure these tickets and then pawn me off on my sister. So, you know.
So what was the, I guess, first punk rock show you wind up going to?
Oh boy, I have to think about that for a minute. I believe it was an X show. Was it X and the Go-Go's at the Whiskey? I'm gonna have to Google that. But I'm thinking it was a show at the Whiskey, and Belinda Carlisle was wearing a garbage bag as a dress. So I'm gonna Google that for a minute.
Yeah.
There it is. This was X and the Flesh Eaters and the Alley Cats. I was at that show.
Oh, I'll have to look for
it, but it was an X and Go-Go's at the Whiskey.
Did you shoot that show?
Nope. The first show I shot was about a year later. It was Wasted Youth and the Circle Jerks at the Whiskey. Oh, was the first show that I shot. Yeah. That was August of 1981.
So I guess going back to that first sort of year that you're going to shows before you're shooting, were there other people around you that you noticed that were shooting at that time? Was that something you were like beginning to get more interested in and pick up on?
There were a couple of photographers. There was Ed Culver and there was another photographer named Gary Leonard who were around at the time. Those were, you know, the main photographers, and there were, you know, a few people running around with cameras, but the ones that that I was aware of were Gary and Ed.
And what were those early shows like during that first year? Because it's such a transition point, I guess, for punk rock in that city.
What was the shows like? I didn't particularly find them. They weren't violent, at least the ones that I went to. I don't remember. You know, they came later, but I remember the shows at the Whiskey specifically because I loved going to the Whiskey. it was a really good place to see a show. Everybody seemed to know each other. You know, the whiskey's not that big, and you know, it's very easy to just see people, you know, and it was very comfortable. Same thing with the Starwood. It was a very comfortable place to see shows. You know, there weren't, you know, it was like a scene. It was kind of intimate. That's how I remember with the early days. And then later when the shows got bigger and, you know, the scene got larger, it attracted, you know, different kinds of people. And, you know, I think that foments, you know, a greater opportunity for conflict.
It's funny you bring, well, not funny, I guess, but you bring that up. And so once again, so many people have brought that up and just so many interpretations of what that meant and what that was like, just the changeover that happened where this sort of smaller community thing that you're talking about kind of got superseded by this much larger sort of punk rock, hardcore punk rock explosion coming from the suburbs mainly.
Totally. And I was, where I lived was, I lived in the Hollywood Hills, but I went to school in the Valley. So, you know, I was, you know, also acquainted with things in like the more suburban area as well.
And was it people like that you knew and met from that first year being driven out? Like, 'cause I've heard so many things about like almost like a complete turnover that kind of happens.
Oh, what do you mean?
Like just people like stop going to shows because of, you know, violence starting to creep in there.
I personally don't, I've never met anybody that says I'm not going to go to shows because they're too violent. I was not, you know, that's not something I saw. Mm-hmm. I was like losing the words there.
Mm-hmm. No, it's funny because like, what, you know, there's so many interpretations of it too that have come up here where there's, you know, people that have been on the show saying, yeah, like what you're saying, like, I didn't really see it like
that. Oh, I found the show.
I found it.
Yeah. It was May of 1980, Exit the Whiskey. And I don't know if that's, the Go-Go's might've been a different show, but yeah, that was I'm looking at the pictures now. Like, there it is. Thank you, Google.
Yeah. Well, it's like, that's the other thing. Like these images, as timeless as they are, they're now kind of like all over the world in a way that, you know, Flipside and books just couldn't be, you know, like this is now, these images are everywhere.
Yeah. And, you know, Flipside, funny you should say that, they were the first publication to publish my work.
Yeah, no, I remember, I actually read something you wrote where you mentioned that. Like, were you a fan of the zine prior to submitting to it? You must have been, right?
Yeah, I was a fan of the zine. It was, you know, it was everywhere. It was at like record stores, you know, on the racks, and I would pick it up and I would read it and I'd buy it. And, you know, I loved the art direction, and it was so, it's just, you know, the mistakes, the cross outs, HUD's little cartoons on the sides of the pages. I just thought it was I'd never seen anything like that. Or there are other magazines that were, you know, put out in Hollywood, like Nomad, which, you know, was a little bit more art focused. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the LA Weekly. But Flipside was just purely punk. And I got the magazine and I got their address and I sent an unsolicited submission to them of Danny from Wasted Youth.
Was it from that first show?
It was from that first show. It was from the first roll of film I shot. Yeah. Oh,
that's awesome. What was that first show, The Circle Jerks and Wasted Youth? Because once again, like, you know, those are kind of like, you know, it's a hairier show than an X show would have been, I imagine.
Well, you know, not really. I mean, they were the same people. At that time, they were the same people. That whiskey show with the Circle Jerks and Wasted Youth. Well, you know, it was, people loved the bands. People were, the club was full. I shot the show from the stage, and it was unlike, you know, just, it wasn't like shows later when I photographed the dead Kennedys, where I literally had to retreat from the stage because I was afraid I was going to get, you know, jumped on. But it, you know, it was energetic and lively, but, you know, again, I didn't get any sense of danger, but, you know, I'm a 54-year-old woman looking back and, you know, it's, it, when you're a 15-year-old kid and you don't look at risk the same way. And I look at some of the things that I do and I go, yeah, that was no big deal. And I think about it now and I go to myself, what was I thinking?
Yeah.
You know, just some of the things that now I would look at as a risk. At the time I thought, eh, nothing of it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's, I guess also when you're part of it, you know, you're not really looking at it the same way an outsider would be looking at it. You know, it's because you're part of the thing that's happening.
Yeah, totally.
What were some of the other early shows that, you know, stuck out to you, or some of the early bands that actually jumped out at you that were fun to shoot?
Yeah, I shot Social Distortion a week after that. Social Distortion and Christian Death. And I, you know, that turned me into a lifelong Social Distortion fan. And then later that year, or a month later, the first time I shot the Dead Kennedys at Florentine Gardens, that was, you know, one of those memorable shows where, you know, there was an element of danger and it was absolutely nuts.
Yeah, like they just seem to be, you know, and once again, I heard about the Circle Jerks, but I guess it's a little later on. When they showed up to town, it would be like an influx of different kids almost. Like it would just be so many more people.
Mm-hmm. But also it's, you know, it's the vibe of the band. Mm. You know, I love Keith and he's a great front man, but his vibe and the energy that he puts out when he sings, totally different than Biafra.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've seen the stage overrun when the Circle Jerks play, but I never felt that I got to get out of here, man.
Yeah.
You know, and I got that at a couple Kennedy shows where it was just like, okay, time to move.
What were some of the other bands that kind of, you know, had that element of danger when you would go and see them?
Black Flag was one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it wasn't because of the band necessarily. It was some of the people that were associated with the band I found to be, you know, less than cordial. It was the only time that I was ever really bullied at a show was at Black Flag shows. They had a particularly aggressive roadie that for whatever reason, as a 15-year-old girl, I got under his skin somehow, and he would lunge at me and push me around and just generally, you know, be, you know, a jerk. Mm. And, you know, I'm not a glutton for punishment. So I stayed away from Black Flag. I've seen them play a lot, but I just didn't photograph them, you know, a lot because of this specifically.
What an asshole.
Total asshole. I don't even, it's been so long ago. I don't have to name him or anything. It's just, I'm sure that, you know, if you had a call in show, he'd probably call in and go, but I've changed.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of those people that, sadly I've heard stories, not about bullying 15-year-olds, mind you, but like, I've definitely heard stories about that person not being the nicest human being back then.
Well, let's be clear. I was a 15-year-old girl, yeah. You know, it's exactly who am I threatening? Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Well, it just also, it's, you know, it's also a scene that can be so welcoming too. It's just like, why bring that to it?
Right. And, you know, I was smart enough to just steer clear.
What was it like to shoot the Misfits early on? Cause you shot them on that first run of LA shows, I think.
Right? I did. How did I end up at that show? There's a story there. It was, was it October of 1981 or 82, October 2nd, it was Misfits and Discharge, I think. And
oh,
the Atoms.
Gosh.
And I'm trying to remember how I ended up at that show. I wanted to see Discharge, for sure, but I was friends with, the guys in Youth Brigade, and Glenn Danzig was friends with the guys in Youth Brigade. And I was over at their apartment, over the hill in Hollywood, and Glenn was there, and I met Glenn and I took him out shopping. You know, we just drove around for a while and I met him, and then I went to the show, and it was incredible. It was incredible at the time because the music was so good with all the bands, but incredible now from a historical point of view, because it was, you know, what a lineup.
Oh yeah. What a incredible, and you said the Atoms as the opener?
Atoms, ATOMS, yeah.
Oh my gosh, Allison, yeah. You have said one of my most, I'm obsessed with this band and fascinated.
With the Atoms?
Yeah, because it's Izzy Stradlin from Guns N' Roses and,
oh, right.
And the guy from DFL.
Monty,
sorry, yeah.
Monty
I bring them up.
And Pat from Junkyard.
Sorry, that's the thing. It's like, what a super group. Prior to, you know, a proto supergroup in the making type thing right there. But yeah, like, and there's virtually nothing about them out there on the internet. And you're the first person who's come on here. Keith said he saw him, but he said he was wasted and had no recollection of the show.
Oh. But I have photos of them from that show.
Oh my, you're blowing my mind.
Because Pat and I were friends. Pat Muzingo and I were friends at the time. Mm-hmm. And so it was, you know, hey, these are my friends opening up. I'm going to take pictures of them.
Oh, that's amazing. I will. Yeah,
Pat was still, he was a senior at Eagle Rock High School.
Are there any photos in your book of the Adams?
No, I put the Force of Discharge in the book. it's expensive to put out a book. And
I get it.
Nothing on Pat or any of those guys. I shot over 200 bands. I couldn't put them all in the book.
Well, if you ever decide to do a sequel zine, because I imagine be slightly less interested in it, but I will definitely buy several copies so I can see them.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll my next Instagram post, I'll put up a photo of the Adams from that show, because I've scanned some of them.
Oh, I would love that. Thank you very much. That is amazing. because it's you know, and we've touched on it a little bit when you talked about the fact that, you know, there's Christian death happening at the same time we X and the Go-Go's. Like, it's amazing just what was happening in that scene at that time, like just the talent and the creativity that was coming out of it.
Well, and you know, the creativity comes from multiple directions, right? There's the musicians, but there were also the people putting out zines and trading tapes and creating t-shirts and also booking shows. The Whiskey is a very prestigious, you know, well-known venue, as was the Starwood, as was the Troubadour. But the other thing that LA was beautiful for is that there were no end of rental halls. American Legion halls, Masonic Temple halls, old theaters in parts of LA. LA was just this canvas of buildings that people would rent to anybody. And there may be, you know, only one or two shows there, but you would get to see bands at these halls that, aside from having, you know, someone's quinceañera, they don't have much of, you know, a following.
What about the police presence? Because you once again hear a lot made of the police presence, particularly at Black Flag shows. But like, was that something that was kind of ever present at these larger shows as they started getting bigger?
I wouldn't say that they were ever present, but they were horrible. This was a time Daryl Gates was the police chief of Los Angeles, and he was more than an asshole. And the police under his leadership were, you know, no better than stormtroopers. And I don't say that lightly. And the reason I don't say that lightly is I witnessed them, you know, for no good reason, coming into shows, beating people up, causing riots when there was absolutely no reason to do that. And it was just, no one, I get emotional thinking about it, because they created problems. There was not a problem, and then they would create a problem. And I remember having this conversation with my dad after, you know, watching an episode of Chips or something. He didn't believe me. You know, he was a Law and Order, you know, gun-toting Republican kind of guy. And I'm like, no, Dad, you don't understand. You know, the cops caused this. And he used to take me to shows, and we went to a show at a place called Bard's Apollo one night, and the cops caused a riot. And, you know, here's my dad, World War II veteran, you know, Law and Order, you know, Brooklyn street guy. And he's just seeing a side of the police that he never believed, you know, he would see, or he never believed existed. And it was shocking.
And I've read that style of policing, like particularly like under Daryl Gates in Los Angeles, that's what was exported kind of around everywhere afterwards. Like, that sort of approach of, like, you know, quote unquote crowd control is kind of the norm now. But it really seems like, from what I've read, that's where it's developing.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I haven't delved into the history of it, but I absolutely wouldn't be surprised, because some of the tactics that they employed for, you know, if you could see me making air quotes going crowd control, driving up on a sidewalk and opening your car door and running people off the sidewalk, tethering people so they can't leave. You tell them to leave and then you block the exits or their exit points where they can't leave. And then you come at them on both sides and beat the crap out of them in the middle. I mean, these are things that you see, that you saw the police doing during Black Lives Matter protests. So, yeah.
You know, not to transition too awkwardly, but to back to a much more pleasant topic, I guess, certainly for me, once again, is Mystic Records.
Oh, yeah.
You eventually become a photographer there. And that's another thing I'm obsessed with.
Thank half my career for Doug Moody.
Yeah, well, that's he's a person who's very much there's a conflicted kind of record on the show about him, I find, depending on who the artist is.
But, yeah, well, it depends on who you talk to.
Yeah.
So here's my take on Doug Moody, who, you know, gave me carte blanche to be in that studio and photograph bands for their albums. You know, if it wasn't for Doug, you know, letting me be there and, you know, be this sort of in-house-ish type of photographer, you know, I wouldn't have made some of the connections and lifelong friendships that I made. But, you know, Doug, you know, his idea, I don't want to, you know, speak for you know, him, but he had a business and he's putting out records. And, you know, these are young kids that want their records. And maybe they're not, you know, savvy in business or understanding what their rights are as artists or, you know, just getting the best deal. But, you know, Doug put out their records and then bands weren't satisfied with, you know, the terms of him putting out their records. And, you know, it's just everyone was young and inexperienced. So, you know, the conflicting things that, you know, I've heard, you know, from Doug is, you know, putting out records or putting out remixes or compilations without people's permission or without band's permission. It's like, well, you know, did you guys even work out a contract? You know, I remember my friends in Dr. No, their first albums were put out on Mystic. And you can't complain if you don't advocate for yourself. You know, these kids just wanted to put out records. You know, they weren't thinking of making money or what happens next. They just wanted records out.
Yeah, and it was, they put out so many records too.
Oh, like, they did. They put a lot of shitty records, but they also put out a lot of good records.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing is like, you know, for everyone from, you know, Hernandez Brothers doing Love and Rockets to like, you know, yourself to, you know, Minutemen Connections to Josh Brolin Connection. Like there's just so many things that tie back to this label that just put out this breadth of music, and for a long run too, like went to like 89, I think, that he was still putting out new records, right?
Was it? Yeah, I don't know. Let's see, when did I stop going to Mystic? It might have been, it was a few years before. There wasn't as late as 89, but yeah, I mean, some of the bands that I worked with, you know, like Dr. No, they were already on Metal Blade by then, and some of the other bands that were on Mystic earlier, I don't think they were putting out records, like Battalion of Saints. I don't know where Aggression ended up. But all of the Oxnard bands had put out a bunch of records on Mystic.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, Aggression winds up, I think they went up on BYO. I think they do the LP.
Yeah, I don't know.
Back on Mystic, I think, again.
So. Yeah, I have photos on their first album, but I can't remember who put that out.
Who was the first band for Mystic you shot? Do you remember?
Let me think about that. I'm just trying to think of how did I even end up there to begin with? I just, because it was right across the street or almost across the street from the Cafe de Grand. Mm-hmm. And I don't even remember how I even ended up there in the first place. So I don't remember. I just remember suddenly I'm there a lot, you know, but I don't remember how I met Doug or Phil, who was their sound guy or not, excuse me, their art, their like, layout artist, Phil Raves.
Yeah, it seems like that Cafe de Grand was like a new scene that kind of emerged at a certain point with like a America's Hardcore, NoFX, Scared Straight, like a whole kind of like, I guess, another wave of bands, it seems.
Yeah, it was definitely a second wave of bands, but it became, ground zero for a lot of those bands. Mm-hmm. lot of the Oxnard bands played there. But I saw Battalion of Saints there a lot. A lot of, you know, just LA bands that, you know, if you didn't see them there, you probably didn't see them at all, because they just, you know, were just punk bands for a little while and they disappeared. But, you know, the Café de Grand was very, very instrumental in that sort of that second wave of small venues that had a lot of shows.
Yeah. Well, and just like it's, you know, be it Rich Kids and LSD or NOFX, or just, you know, these are bands that really shaped the way punk was going to sound and like ultimately usher in that huge commercial boom in the late 90s.
Yeah. I was just, you know, it was Mike Burkett and I were just talking last week, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to help him on something that he's doing. And, you know, I just remember we were kids. We were both Misfits fans.
It all comes back to the Misfits.
Misfits.
What were some of the other more memorable bands that you remember working with at Mystic or in sessions there?
I mentioned Battalion of Saints, and that's how I met them, was there. And I ended up photographing them a lot. And there's an image of Chris Smithis on the cover of my book. So that they were one of the bands that I really, you know, connected with over at Mystic. Oh, and then also I didn't meet them at Mystic, but I had this, you're going to laugh, this really incredibly existential conversation with El Duce one afternoon there. You know, I kid you not. It was broad daylight. I was there for, you know, taking photos of, I think it might've been the Battalion of Saints or something. And Eldon was there, and he wasn't drunk and he wasn't on a high. He was just, you know, Eldon. And we talked about his family, and he was from Seattle, and his family, you know, how he had, you know, ancestors that were in the Civil War. And we just talked about him, you know, he talked about himself and his life, and he was coherent, and it turned out to be this like great conversation.
Wow. He's much a person like Doug Moody that seems to have, you know, like Penelope Sirius was just on the show a couple of weeks ago and was like, he was a bad person. And then there's other people that talk about what a great person he was. And it's so weird. He played in a band with the Screamers when he was in Seattle too.
He did. But he had already, obviously I'm in Seattle now, but he was firmly in the Mentors. And honestly, I could understand Penelope's point of view of being a bad person. You know, he kind of was, if you think about it. You know, he would go up to some woman, you know, I've seen him do it, and he's like, you know, hey bitch, you want to suck my dick? Excuse me, I don't know if I could say that on the air, and people would laugh at him because it's El Duce. And, you know, Guar played one night at this club called the Country Club, and a girl got up on stage and did exactly that to him. And it's, you know, it's this persona that he had, that if you're a feminist now looking back, you're like, this guy's a bad person. Look what he sings about. Look what he does. Look what he says. And everyone treated him like a joke. But to me, he was a really tragic figure. You know, his life was one big cry for help. Mm. You know, he was impaired, and people egged him on because they liked to see him perform for them like a trained monkey. But I always tried to look past that with him. And as a result of that, he always treated me with respect. And, you know, I enjoyed talking to him. I introduced him to my dad, you know, I just at the Café de Grand one night, I'm like, Eldon, meet my dad, you know, go over there and talk about war stories. You know, I mean, that was, and, you know, I tell this to people and they couldn't believe at the time. They're like, your dad's over there with El Duce. I'm like, yeah. So
when did you start traveling for shows, or what was the first shows? Did you go down to San Diego to shoot Battalion of Saints ever?
I went down to San Diego with Dr. No to play at a show. I didn't, you know, if I traveled that far away from LA, I'd usually go with bands that were playing. Mm-hmm. And I went to San Diego and I shot Discharge in their metal years, which we don't talk about. And I would go as far north as San Francisco. I drive up there to see shows because I had friends in Maximum Rock and Roll and I could stay at the Maximum Rock and Roll house. But I didn't go drive across country or drive, you know, into the Midwest, on tour with bands. I just stayed in the LA, Southern California area.
Those three scenes that you mentioned there, San Francisco and San Diego and Los Angeles, obviously, they all seem so different. What were your sort of interpretations of it, or you know, your takeaways from going to these different places versus Los Angeles?
Well, you know, San Francisco always said to me, and maybe it was just the Dead Kennedys influence, was much more political. Mm-hmm. And I attribute that to my relationship with Maximum Rock and Roll, which, you know, had a very, you know, political aspect to it. And the bands, I felt, you know, mostly, you know, Dead Kennedys influence had a much, much more political message. Los Angeles, to me, you know, there were bands with political messages, but a lot of them were, you know, straight edge, skate punk, just straight thrash, you know, mm-hmm. America's hardcore, that type of, you know, stuff. And San Diego, you know, I didn't spend a lot of time in San Diego, but it's, you know, much more of a surf influenced area, kind of like Ventura in Northern Cal, you know, up north a bit. So it was much more influenced, you know, by a surf community. That was, you know, what I thought. But they, you know, completely different cities, completely different vibe in those cities. And San Diego was also got a lot of people from Tijuana that could come to shows because it was just over the border. So it wasn't that far. If you were a punk in Mexico, mm-hmm. you'd come to a show in San Diego.
Yeah, I spent a little time in Tijuana. It really does feel like it's kind of one city with a border cutting it in half.
Yeah, I think it's a little different now, but you know, it was really easy to go back and forth between you know, California and Mexico. I went there for parties. I went there for, you know, just weekends. It was really super easy.
I was there a few years ago, and I felt even then, even with like a 5-hour wait to get across that border, there were still kids like living on one side of the border, going to school on the other, or,
yeah,
you know, it felt like there was still that kind of thing, but I guess it would have been much more easier then.
Yeah. There was never a 5-hour wait at the border. Yeah. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. So I also heard that San Diego, from people that were from that scene, was somehow a more violent scene. I don't mean to keep coming back to the violence thing, but it just seems like something that's brought up a lot about these scenes.
Well, you know, I can't really, I didn't spend a lot of time in San Diego, mm-hmm. but I don't know what it is about coastal communities and punk rock violence. I mean, I was just thinking of Venice, Huntington Beach, yeah. San Diego. It's like, what is with you guys, like with the Pacific Ocean and punk rock, you know, hooliganism? I don't know.
Well, once again, like, you know, Keith brought up an interesting point, which I never thought about, but he was like, because these are like kind of jock communities just by the nature of being by the beach. Like, people are more outdoorsy, more aggressive. Like, you know, even if it's just like fishing or beach volleyball or something, like, it is a different mentality.
Yeah. I was just thinking of like a jock mentality, and I didn't pay attention to that. You know, I didn't subscribe to that. I just did my own thing.
What was it like? When did you move up to Seattle?
I moved to Seattle in 1990.
And I guess, what was it like prior to moving up there, you know, in that period in Los Angeles? Because it seems like, once again, more of a lean years before there's like another boom in the late 80s in there. Like, obviously metal's taken off and is huge. But
yeah, by that time, I don't know what happened to me, but I ended up shooting a lot of metal acts towards the late 80s. A lot of it was, you know, the punk crossover mm-hmm. scene had me going to a lot of shows. The Balboa Theater was one of those halls I was telling you about in South Central LA that had a lot of these crossover shows for a period of time. So, you know, punk at that point had sort of morphed into more of, you know, less of pure punk and more speed metal, you know, sort of influence coming into the music.
What about bands like, because I guess it's also the birth of, like, you know, Bad Religion kind of comes back to the known, and Pennywise is starting to get going a little bit around then too. So was that stuff that you were picking up on, or is metal kind of the dominant thing?
Pennywise was way after I left. Bad Religion was always a band. You know, they I knew those guys. You know, they were some of the first people I met, you know, and they were always there. They played a lot of shows. They were always in the scene. I don't think, you know, they disappeared from where we were. Mm-hmm. You know, Pennywise became a thing after I'd left Los Angeles.
Yeah, like I guess they put out that first 7-inch in 89, but it's not really a thing until a little bit later.
Yeah. And, you know, that was not, you know, that was post me, I guess. I had moved to Seattle and was starting to shoot the Seattle bands.
And what was your impressions of Seattle when you got up there? Because that's like, you know, just as things are about to explode.
Yeah, for, you know, forgive all of my Seattle people, friends, they're all going to like, you know, come show up at my house with pitchforks. But I thought, what is with this town? You know, there's like nothing going on here. And this is, you know, arguably at one of the most influential points in the Seattle music scene. And, you know, you couldn't get dinner after 9 p.m. unless, you know, you tried really hard. So, you know, Seattle was just on the verge of exploding, and there were a few venues, but they had these weird teenage dance laws where, you know, you had to be 21 to go into a club. So a whole generation of kids didn't even get to see bands, you know. In LA, we didn't have, well, most of the time we didn't have that. So it was, you know, bars had bands playing, but there weren't those, a lot of those shows that had these all ages big shows. They didn't, I don't think there were a lot of those in Seattle, at least not when I was there.
So who were sort of the first bands that you kind of picked up on there? Cause I know you obviously, I've seen your photos of Accused and Alice in Chains, but like, who were the first bands that you took to?
Soundgarden was, cause I had photographed them in Los Angeles before I moved up. So it was, you know, Soundgarden, Mudhoney, Alice in Chains, Accused, later Grunt Truck, Skin Yard, Dehumanizers.
I love the Dehumanizers.
Who else? And then Hammerbox, Slam Suzanne, The Gits. What else am I? There's like a whole bunch of Candlebox. You know, just a lot of bands up here. And then there were also, Seattle also had a really good emergent metal scene, you know, Sanctuary, Bitter End, you know, Panic, Forced Entry, you know, they had a pretty decent metal scene as well.
It feels like there's just, you know, once again, it's so small, geographically speaking, compared to, I guess, essentially compared to Los Angeles. But, you know, you mentioned that metal scene, there's that, you know, the grunge scene, whatever that would become. There's also like a hardcore scene with bands like Brotherhood.
Brotherhood.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, here's the one I forgot. Nirvana. Gosh, I knew I was missing somebody. Yeah. Like, how did I forget? Oops. Oh, Presidents of the United States of America, the Posies. Like, oops, sorry. Forgot that.
Well, like, you know, I think we all knew that was there. So. What was your take on them? Because that's another band that people have differing opinions on.
Which one?
Nirvana. Like when you saw them back then.
I liked them. You know, I didn't photograph them. You know, it was one of the tragedies of my career. But you know, I thought they were just a hell of a band to watch. Mm-hmm. You know, their music is incredible. Mm-hmm. It's still incredible. Listen to it now. It's still incredible.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. It's also, I find funny that how many people that just kind of, I guess, grew up around it are just like, yeah, it was just like another band that was happening at the time.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, did you have a sense that any of these bands, like any of that stuff that was going to happen in the scene was about to happen? Because you'd been through a lot in Los Angeles and seen a lot happen.
Oh, I totally knew it. And I'm not saying that to be smug. It's just that I had this sense from when I started taking pictures that this is a historical opportunity. And I knew that I was capturing something that was a once in a lifetime historical event, you know, a period in time, you know, not unlike, say, the birth of rock and roll. I mean, and maybe that's probably a little bit too romantic, but, you know, there is never going to be another time in history like there was that, the access to people, the lack of technology. You know, this was before smartphones. This is, if you wanted to record a show, you have a tape recorder and hold up a boom. You know, I mean, there wasn't, you know, there wasn't a lot. No one had smartphones. Hell, no one had cell phones. I mean, it was just a very analog sort of existence. You'd go to a show, you'd buy an album or a CD, and you'd get a t-shirt. There wasn't social media, and it was just, it was very simple. Mm-hmm. And there will never be another time like that again.
Yeah, and it's funny because, you know, even though now the technology, like you're saying, is all in our pockets at all times, people don't really treasure it in the way they do. Like, as hard as it was to record a show back then, there seems like there's bootlegs of most of those bands. Yet more recently, people, like, you know, they'll film part of a song to post on their Instagram, but no one's sitting there, you know, recording a whole show with a boom mic, sneaking it in there anymore.
No, people are holding up their iPhones, yeah. Which, by the way, you know, humiliatingly, take really good pictures. I did this thing where my friends in Channel 3 were touring with Fear, and I went and shot their show at a place in Seattle called The Showbox. And I brought my professional 35 millimeter SLR camera and my iPhone, and I shot the bands on both. And I looked at the pictures on my iPhone, and I never picked up my 35 millimeter camera again. So can I even call myself a photographer at that point, you know?
Well, I think it's all about also being there, like capturing those moments, right? Like, yeah. That's the thing, like you captured so many just moments of this energy that, like, you know, I think more than just the film or the camera, like it was
right.
You capturing this stuff.
And I think that the ability to be able to do that stems from the fact that early on, there was not a delineation between audience and band. Mm-hmm. If you look at early punk shows, you'll see that, you know, people are around on the stage. They're sitting there. They're very close to the band. The band is very close to the audience. There isn't this elevation of the band away from the audience. Later, what you see in shows where they put barriers in front of the stage and they had bouncers all over the place that and you know, couldn't get as close to the band as you wanted to, you know, this early time was just very special because it was very intimate. And I could get in there and literally get in someone's face and take their picture and be part of what was going on. And instead of just being, you know, a viewer, I was a participant because I was so close to that. And that's one of the things I miss about shooting shows now, is that you don't have that intimacy with the bands anymore.
Who are some of your favorite bands of all time to shoot? Like, who do you think are some of the great, you know, photogenic bands?
The great photogenic bands. I did a thing on Facebook a while ago. I did a poll. It's like trying to get people to guess what band I photographed the most. And Blast from Santa Cruz won.
Awesome band. Yes.
Bar none, the most favorite band I ever wanted to shoot. They were just amazing. So I loved shooting them. I loved shooting early Soundgarden. You know, their presence was just incredible. Dead Kennedys were a favorite of mine to shoot. Jello Biafra had this great pantomime, you know, these faces and these movements that just captured really well. And I also loved shooting Social Distortion.
It seems like all these people, like, you know, especially Jello and Mike Ness must have been, well, you see it, I guess, in Another State of Mind, but like looking in the mirror, pulling these faces, because they definitely know how to, like, they look like models up there on stage.
But they've always been like that. That's so weird. It's like, I looked at my pictures of Mike Ness that I shot in 1981 at the Whiskey, and when I say Mike, you haven't changed. It's Mike, you haven't changed. You were incredible then. And, you know, 40 years later, you're still incredible. He has a presence about him that he's had that confidence as a young man and as, you know, sort of an elder statesman of alternative music.
And you mentioned Nirvana, like who would be some of the other bands that you wish you had shot or just, you know, didn't get around to shooting?
Minor Threat.
Yep.
That was the other one.
Were you at that show?
No, I had a nose job and didn't go to the show. Yeah. Sorry, Ian, rhinoplasty kept me from seeing you.
That is the best story. Yeah. Who are the worst bands to shoot? Like, be it like, you know, not necessarily because they're bad people, like in the case of, you know, Black Flag Roadies and stuff, but I mean, like, just because it's difficult to capture them.
Oh my God, Bad Brains. I spent like 5 years trying to get one good picture of them. And I love that band. And I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. I have some good pictures of Bad Brains, but I look at some of the stuff like Glenn Friedman shot of, you know, I forgot to mention Glenn. Boy, sorry, Glenn. You know, he was always at shows too. Mm-hmm. But he has the most incredible pictures of Bad Brains. I look at mine, I'm like, what the heck happened? And, you know, HR was bouncing around and he moved so quickly that my shots were always just 1 second off, you know, just, and I was just, I never liked my pictures of Bad Brains. So that was the most difficult band. And I love them. That's not, you know, in a bad way. I did some very nice portraits of them at someone's house in Hollywood that were nice, but my live shots of them are just, they kind of suck.
Well, it seems like a good band to have to keep trying again with, because you at least get to see them a few more times.
There's one in my book I don't mind, but if, you know, I look at the stuff that's out there and you know, I could have done better. I wish I did better.
I've seen the photos you've taken of the Stains. What was it like shooting the Stains? Or what were those shows even like?
Well, they were always part of when I shot the Stains, they were, you know, part of a larger show. I shot them at Devonshire Downs. That was the first time I shot them. I think it was Black Flag, DOA, and the Stains was the lineup. And Rudy Navarro, he had a hearse that he drove around in. But also, it, you know, as being, you know, people of color, you know, it was nice to see some diversity in the bands. Mm-hmm.
And they're definitely a band that I think, you know, like recently, like the last sort of 4 or 5 years, people's obsession with them has really grown. I think there's a documentary.
They were a good band.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the record's incredible. Like, mm-hmm. that SST catalog, like you mentioned, of course, Blast and early Soundgarden, but it's just, once again, like, maybe not the best at necessarily paying some of the bands from what people have said on the show, but at the same time, like, what an ear for all different bands that would become important, legendary.
Yeah, totally. I totally agree.
I've kept you for a long time, Allison.
No, that's all right.
At some point in the future, would you come back and do a part two?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love doing this. I want my art to be seen. I want people, you know, to have access to it. This is why I've been on this journey of scanning all my images and putting them out there on social media. And just, I want people to see them. I'm not getting any younger. And, you know, I'm trying to think about what my legacy is going to be, you know, and what pleases me the most is that I talk to people that have contacted me and say, hey, you got pictures of China White? I'm like, yeah, I got pictures of China White. James is my dad, you know. I mean, and yeah. it's to see these second generation of, you know, people's kids growing up, or, you know, looking at their parents and buying images of mine that this is their dad or their mother. And I just, that brings me joy to see that, you know, that another generation will discover my work. And, you know, I really want people to see it and have it be accessible.
Well, and as I was telling you, you know, before we got on the podcast, like, your photos are just so key for people like myself that weren't there and obsessed with this music to kind of, you know, like, it's photojournalism, like in the truest sense, because you were in the middle of the action, like you're in the pit shooting all this stuff.
Yeah, and it was photojournalism. My fifth period journalism class. With Mr. Yeah. Bickerstaff at North Hollywood High School. I submitted my punk rock photography more than once.
Oh, that's awesome. Did he appreciate the music, or is it just based totally on the images?
I don't know if he appreciated the music, but he liked the pictures and my articles that I wrote. You know, it was interesting, you know, because I was writing for Maximum Rock and Roll and for Flipside, and you know, turning them in as homework. Like, okay, hey, check it out. I had something in the New York Times today. Look, do I get credit?
You cracked the matrix there. You figured out how to get paid to do homework.
I totally did. Yeah, I got paid to do homework. paid for my college too.
That's amazing. That's awesome. So what's the reception been like for your stuff? Like you're putting it out to like a whole new generation of people.
Yeah, and if I found that, you know, especially on social media, if I make one mistake,
People are idiots.
People are brutal to me. Yeah. You know, I'll misspell a name, or I'll do a wrong venue, and you know, within seconds, you know, the trolls come at me. I'm like, look, guys, this is coming out of my head.
Yeah, no, it's and it's like a bunch of fucking people that are reading about it on the internet, complaining to someone that was fucking there, and the only reason they know about it is because of your photos.
Right. And people arguing with me that weren't there about some minutia, and I have to say, no, I'm sorry.
It's people are ridiculous, and it's especially now with Instagram, like it's just, you know, the way people act like they own these images and the way that they were there is fucking weird. And
recently, I mean, I say within the last year, I started watermarking my images. Ed Culver and I used to have arguments over this. He says, you got to watermark your images. And I said, I'm not going to watermark my images. They look like shit when you watermark your images. And then, you know, my images started to get co-opted. And that picture of Circle One that you saw, mm-hmm. Someone had co-opted it and claimed credit for it and put it on their Pinterest page. And when I saw that, I'm like, okay, this is why we can't have nice things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, started watermarking my images right across the center, you know, almost like a fuck you, but you're seeing it for free. You know, come on, guys. I'm sharing you unpublished images for free. You want to buy one, I'll take the watermark off. And people were coming at me, you know, of just like, it looks like shit when you do this. It's, you know, get with the times, you know, lady, that, you know, you don't own anything. This is the internet age. Everything is everybody's. I'm like, horse shit. You know, this is my work, my copyright. You know, my page, my rules. So if you want to see my pictures on Instagram, they're going to have a watermark on them. If you want to share them, since you don't know how to type my name for credit, you get the credit built into the photo. Look at that. All for free.
Well, I don't care how big the watermark is. If I can see the Adams photo finally and put faces to this, you know, name that's haunted my dreams, I will be very happy.
Really? Do you talk to Monty or Pat? Do you know those guys?
No, I've never met any of them. It's so weird because, you know, you brought up Youth Brigade earlier. Like I'm obsessed with record collecting. I'm surrounded by records right now. And the Extreme and the Zeros both put out their 7-inch on this label that the only other record they put out was, you know, 7 years later, they put out an Adams 7-inch, which is a live recording. And that's where I found out about it. And it was all of a sudden, it was like, oh my gosh, it's like a DFL Guns N' Roses, like pre-band.
Junkyard pre-band, yeah.
That's like, it's mind-blowing. Like, how could this thing exist? And how can we not be talking about it? You know, like, much like we talked about, you know, the Tupperwares with members of the Screamers, and Nikki Sixx was in it for a minute, and El Duce, of course, was in it. Like, how are we not? These are the bands that I want to know about. Like, we've got enough of these documentaries about some of these bands. These are the ones we should be studying.
We should totally be studying. And you know, we should also be studying, like, the relationship of, like, Motley Crue with punk bands. I mean,
yeah,
these shows at the Whiskey would have, you know, a metal band at night and then a punk band earlier in the show. I mean, I saw, you know, these crazy combinations of bands.
Now I'm blanking on the name, but there's like some sort of like power pop band that I think the guy from the Simpletones joined after Vince Neil left, when Vince Neil was the singer in it. And it's kind of like glammy power pop. I wish I could remember the name right now. They did a 7-inch, but without Vince Neil singing, with the guy from the Simpletones singing.
I can't remember that one.
I'm totally blanking on it. Anyway, I've punished you long enough.
Sorry about that.
Please know, anytime you want to come back, I'd love to have you on the show.
Yeah. You know, just find me on, you know, the listeners can find me as Allison Braun Photo on Instagram. And I got books for sale on my website, AllisonBraun.com. So.
Well, thank you for years of giving images to the sounds that I was listening to.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Allison, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Allison will be back for a part two at some point in the near future. And yeah, once again, check out her photography, check out her website, check out her Instagram, and also definitely pick up that book. AllisonBraun.com is the website right there. And speaking of, did I say future? Ah, fuck it. Sometimes I forget it. Anyway, coming up on the next episode of the show, we got a wild one for you. Joe Manganiello is on the show next. And yep, that's right. Deathstroke. Deathstroke's here. El Cid. My wife and my kids are stoked. They are very, very excited about this guest. And so am I, because not only do I get to talk to him about music, but I also get to talk to him about Dungeons and Dragons. So that's like, you know, we're all ticking boxes off with next week's guest. And Joe is awesome. So I can't wait to speak to you then. That's it. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous people matter. We need to protect trans kids, and we need to help trans people protect themselves. Go out there and get informed right now. Read about people's experiences. Read about what's going on. You know, get involved. Sign up for organizations. Be involved with demonstrations. Donate. We need to smash fascism. This is basically what this all comes down to, because it sucks. And that's that. Also, go out there and make your own culture, you know, because it helps. It helps with your mental health, and it helps you. It helps. And you don't have to put it out there, but you can. And then people respond to it potentially, and you can meet new people and build community that way and stuff. So be creative is basically what it comes down to. Make a zine, start a label, just draw, just paint, play an instrument, whatever, whatever works for you. Wear a mask. Definitely please wear a mask. Wash your hands. Definitely wash your hands. Sign your organ donor cards. Definitely, because you know they don't matter once you're gone. You know those things. So give them away, and then maybe help someone else. It's a real nice thing to do. And this is another thing that you know, I feel weird recommending because I'm really new to it, but I found it's been incredibly beneficial for me in the last few weeks. Try meditating. And it took me forever to do this. I've been trying for like 10 years to do this shit. And yeah, it really helps. It took a long time to kind of click, but it's really been helping me. And I'm new to it. So try it. You know, there's tons of shit on the internet. You can try it for free. You don't have to buy an app. You know, you can. You know, it's probably easier with one of those. But, you know, there's shit on the internet to try it out first and see if it works for you. But and stick with it, because it can be frustrating, very frustrating at first. But when it clicks, it clicks. And yeah, that's it. These are no set of rules. I'm not telling you how to live your life. But at the same time, these are things that I believe. So that is that. Thank you for listening, as always. I love talking to you, and I love doing this thing. Thank you to my brother, and thank you to you. All right. See you next episode.